reasonably. I'm crazy about Mick, okay? But that doesn't mean I can't do my part for the proliferation of the Widow's Peaks. As a favor, to the gene pool. You would too, right? Or maybe... She shot Carew a sidelong glance. You already have. What? Carew was aghast. No! What do you think I am? She was certain Akiva couldn't understand, but there was an amused quirk to his mouth. He asked what Zuzana had said, and Carew felt her face flame crimson. Nothing, she told him in Chimera. In Czech, she added sternly. She did not say anything. Yes, I did, piped Zuzana. And like a child who has gotten a reaction for naughty antics, she merrily repeated, Mating? Seed? Zuz, stop, please, begged Carew, helpless and so very glad the two had no common language. Fine, said her friend. I can be polite. Observe. She addressed Akiva directly. Welcome to our world, she said with exaggerated gestures. I hope that you're enjoying your visit. Chewing on a smile, Carew translated. Akiva nodded. Thank you. To Carew, would you tell her, please, that her performance was beautiful? Carew did. I know, agreed Zuzana. It was her standard acceptance of a compliment, but Carew could tell she was pleased. It was Carew's idea. Carew didn't convey that. She said instead, She's an amazing artist. So are you, Akiva replied, and it was Carew's turn to be pleased. She told him they went to school for the arts, and he said they had nothing like that in his world, only apprenticeships. She told him that Zuzana was kind of like an apprentice, that she came from a family of artisans, and she wondered if he was from a family of soldiers. In a manner of speaking, he replied. His siblings were soldiers, and so had his father been in his day. He said the word father with an edge, and Carew sensed animosity and didn't press, and talk shifted back to art. The conversation filtered through Carew, and Zuzana, even on her best behavior, required a high degree of filtering, was surprisingly easy. Too easy, she thought. Why was it so easy for her to laugh with this Seraph, and keep forgetting the image of the fiery portal and Kishmish's little raw body as his heartbeat went wild and then failed? She had to keep reminding herself, chastening herself, and even so, when she looked at Akiva, it all wanted to slip away, all her caution and self-control. After a moment, he remarked, nodding toward Zuzana, She's not actually very scary. You had me worried. Well, you disarm her. You have that effect. I do. It didn't seem to work on you yesterday. I had more reason to fight it, she said. I have to keep reminding myself we are enemies. It was as if a shadow fell over them. Akiva's expression turned remote again, and he put his hands under the table, removing his tattoos from her sight. What did you just say to him? Zuzana asked. I reminded him that we're enemies.
Whatever you are, Carew, you are not enemies.
But we are, she said. And they were, no matter how powerfully her body was trying to convince her otherwise.
Then what are you doing, watching sunrises and drinking tea with him?
You're right. What am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. She thought of what she should be doing, getting herself to Morocco to find Razgat, flying through that slash in the sky to Eretz. A chill snaked through her. She'd been so focused on getting Gavriel's that she'd avoided thinking too much about what it would be like to actually go. And now, with Akiva's depiction of his world fresh in her mind, war-torn, bleak, dread crept over her. Suddenly, she didn't want to go anywhere. What was she supposed to do when she got there anyway? Fly up to the bars of that forbidding fortress and politely ask if Brimstone was at home? Speaking of enemies, Zuzana said, Jackass was on TV this morning. Good for him,
said Carew, still in her own thoughts. No, not good. Bad. Bad jackass. Oh, no. What did he do?
While you've been watching sunrises with your enemy, the news has been all over you, and a certain actor has been most helpful preening for the camera and telling the world all about you. Like, bullet scars? He's made you out to be some kind of gangster's moll.
Moll? Please, if anything, I'm the gangster.
Anyway, Zuzana cut her off. I'm sorry to say that whatever anonymity you might have had blue-haired girl, your flying stunt put an end to it. The police are probably at your flat.
What?
Yeah. They're calling your flight a disturbance and saying they just want to talk to the, people involved, if anyone knows their whereabouts.
Akiva, seeing her distress, wanted to know what was being said. She quickly translated. His look darkened. He stood and moved to the door, glancing out.
Will they come for you here? He asked.
Carew saw the protectiveness in his stance, shoulders hunched and tense, and she realized that in his world, such a threat might be much more dire.
It's okay, she assured him. It's not like that. They would just ask questions, really.
He didn't move away from the door.
We didn't break any laws.
She turned to Zuzana and switched to check. It's not like there's a law against flying.
Yes, there is. The law of gravity.
The point is that you are looked for.
She shot a glance at the waitress who was skulking nearby and most certainly eavesdropping.
Isn't that right?
The waitress blushed.
I haven't called anyone,
she was quick to say.
You're okay to stay here. Do you want more tea?
Zuzana waved her off and told Carew,
You can't stay here forever, obviously.
No. So what's the plan?
Plan. She had a plan, and it was near its fruition. All she had to do now was go. Leave her life here. Leave school. Her flat. Zuzana.
Akiva.
No, Akiva was not part of her life. Carew looked at him, watchful in the doorway, ready to protect her, and she tried to imagine walking away from the placeness of him, the rightness, the patch of sunlight, the pull. All she had to do was get up and leave, right? A moment passed in silence, and Carew's body did not so much as twitch in response to the idea of leaving.
The plan, she said, exerting a massive effort of will and facing up to it.
The plan is to go away.
Akiva had been looking out the door, and only when he pivoted to face her did she realize she'd spoken in chimera, addressing this to him.
Away? Where?
Eretz, she said, standing up. I told you. I'm going to find my family.
Dismay spread over his face as understanding dawned.
You really have a way to get there.
I really do.
How?
There are more portals than just yours.
There were. All knowledge of them was lost with the Magi. It took me years to find this one.
You're not the only one who knows things, I guess. Though I would rather you showed me the way.
Then who?
He was thinking, trying to figure it out, and Carew saw by the flicker of disgust when he did.
The Fallen. That thing. You're going to that thing.
Not if you take me instead.
I truly can't, Carew. The portal is under guard.
Well then, maybe I'll see you on the other side sometime. Who knows?
A rustle from his unseen wings sent sparks shivering across the floor.
You can't go there. There's no kind of life there, trust me.
Carew turned away from him and picked up her coat, slipping it on and fanning out her hair, which had a damp mermaid quality to it, and lay in coils over her shoulders. She told Zuzana that she was leaving town, and she was fending off her friend's inevitable queries when Akiva took her elbow. Gently.
You can't go with that creature. His expression was guarded, hard to read. Not alone. If he knows another portal, I can come with you and make sure you're safe. Karu's first impulse was to refuse. Be that cat. Be that cat. But who was she fooling? That wasn't the cat she wanted to be. She didn't want to go alone. Or alone with Razgut, which was worse. Her heart hammering, she said, okay. And once the decision was made, a tremendous burden of dread lifted. She wouldn't have to part with Akiva. Yet, anyway. Chapter 34. What's a day? What's a morning? Karu asked herself. A part of her was already flying into the future, imagining what her reunion with Brimstone would be like. But another part of her was settled firmly in her skin, mindful of the heat of Akiva's arm against her shoulder. They were walking down Nuradova with Susanna, against the flow of tourists heading up to the castle, and they had to press close to navigate a horde of Germans in sensible shoes. She had her hair tucked away in a hat, borrowed from the waitress, so her most obvious feature was disguised. Akiva was still drawing an inordinate amount of attention, but Karu thought it was mostly because of his otherworldly beauty and not recognition from the news. I have to stop by school, Susanna said. Come with me. Karu wanted to go there anyway. It was part of her goodbye program. So she agreed. She'd have to wait until nightfall anyway to get back in her flat, if the police were watching it. After dark, she could return by way of sky and balcony, instead of street and elevator, and get the things she'd need for her journey. What's a day? She asked herself. And there was a buzzing happiness in her that she had to admit had a lot to do with the way Akiva had stood in the tea house doorway, and the solidity of him beside her now in all its rightness. There was wrongness, too, faint and flickering, but she attributed that to nerves, and as the morning went by in its buzz of unlooked-for happiness, she kept brushing it aside, unconsciously, as one might fan at a fly. Karu said her goodbyes to the Lyceum, in her head only, not wanting to alarm Susanna. And, afterward, to Poison Kitchen, she laid a fond hand on the marble flank of Pestilence and ran her fingers over the slightly ratty velvet of the settee. Akiva took the place in with a puzzled expression, coffins and all, and called it morbid. He ate a bowl of goulash, too. But Karu didn't think he would be asking for the recipe anytime soon. She saw her two haunts with new eyes being there with him, and was humbled to think how little she had really internalized the fact of the wars that had shaped them. At school, some joker had scrawled a red graffiti Volnost, Liberty, where freedom fighters had once written it in Nazi blood, and in Poison she had to explain gas masks to Akiva, and that they came from a different war than the Volnost did. These are from World War I, she said, putting one on. 100 years ago. The Nazis came later. She gave him a tart sideward glance. And just so you know, the invaders are always the bad guys. Always. Mick joined them, and it was a little strained at first because he didn't know anything of other worlds and other races, and believed Karu was just eccentric. She told him the truth, that they had really been flying, and that Akiva was an angel from another world, but in her accustomed manner, so that he thought she was teasing him. But his eyes kept going to Akiva with the same kind of astonished appraisal as everyone else's did, and Karu, watching, saw that it made Akiva uncomfortable. It struck her that there was nothing in his manner at all to suggest he knew the power of his beauty. Later, the four of them walked on to the Charles Bridge. Mick and Susanna were a few steps ahead, entwined, as if nothing could ever shoehorn them apart. Karu and Akiva trailing. We can leave for Morocco tonight, Karu said. I was going to take an airplane, but I don't think that's an option for you. No.
No. You'd need a passport, a document saying your nationality, which tends to assume you are from this actual world.
You can still fly, yes?
Karu tested her ability, rising a discreet few inches off the ground and coming right back down. It's a long way, though. I'll help you.
Even if you couldn't fly, I could carry you.
She imagined crossing the Alps and the Mediterranean in Akiva's arms. It wasn't the worst thing she could think of, but still, she was no damsel in distress.
I'll manage, she said.
Up ahead, Mick dipped Zuzana into a back-bending kiss, and Karu came to a halt, flustered by their display. She turned to the bridge railing and looked out over the river. It must be weird for you just doing nothing all day. Akiva nodded. He was looking out too, leaning on the railing, one of his elbows against hers. It didn't escape Karu's notice that he found subtle ways of touching her.
I keep trying to imagine my own people living like this, and I can't.
How do they live? She asked.
War is all. If they're not fighting it, they're providing for it, and living in fear always. There is no one without loss.
And the Chimera? What are their lives like? He hesitated.
There's no good life there for anyone. It's not a safe place.
He laid a hand on her arm.
Karu, your life is here in this world. If Brimstone cares about you, he can't want you to go to that broken place. You should stay.
His next words were a whisper. She barely heard them, and afterward wasn't entirely sure she had. He said,
I could stay here with you.
His grip was firm, and it was soft. His hand on her arm was warm and it was right. Karu let herself pretend, just for a moment, that she could have what he had whispered. A life with him. Everything she had always craved was right here. Solidity. A mooring love. Love. The word, when it came to her, wasn't jarring or preposterous, as when Zuzana had uttered it that morning at the tea house. It was tantalizing. Karu didn't think. She reached for Akiva's hand and shocked a pulse into it. She jerked back, her hamsa. She'd laid it full against his skin. Her palm burned, and Akiva had been knocked back a step. He stood there, holding his magic scorched hand to his body as a shudder passed through him. His jaw was clenched with the endurance of pain. Pain. Again.
I can't even touch you, Karu said. Whatever Brimstone wants for me, it's not you, or he wouldn't have given me these.
Her own hands, clasped tight to her chest, felt evil to her in that moment. She reached into her collar and fished up her wishbone, took it into her hand and held it tight for comfort.
Akiva said, You don't have to want what he wants.
I know that, but I have to know what's happening there. I have to know. Her voice was ragged. She wanted him to understand, and he did. She saw it in his eyes, and with it the helplessness and anguish she'd seen in glints and glimmers since he had come into her life the night before. Only the night before. It was unbelievable it had been so short a time. You don't have to come with me.
Of course I'm coming with you.
Karu. His voice was still whisper soft.
Karu.
He reached out and eased the hat from her head so that her hair spilled out in a splash of blue, and he tucked an errant strand behind her ear. He took her face in his hands, and a sunburst went off in Karu's chest. She held herself quiet. Her motionlessness belying the rushing within her. No one had ever looked at her like Akiva was right now. His eyes held wide, as if he wanted to take more of her into himself, like light through a window. One of his hands slipped softly around the nape of her neck, twining through her hair
and sending frisson of longing through her body. She felt herself giving way, melting toward him. One booted foot slid forward so her knee brushed his and settled against it, and the remaining space between them, negative space, it was called in drawing, called out to be closed. Was he going to kiss her? Oh God, did she have goulash breath? Never mind, he had it too. Did she want him to kiss her? His face was so close she could see the sun dusky on his lashes, and her own face centered in the deep black of his pupils. He was gazing into her eyes as if there were worlds within her, wonders and discoveries. Yes, she did want him to kiss her. Yes. His hand slipped down her throat to find her hand, which was still cupping the wishbone on its cord. Its flanges protruded through the webbing of her fingers, and when Akiva felt them there, he stopped. Something in his gaze froze. He looked down. His breath caught. With a hitch, he inhaled and opened Karu's hand, with no caution for her Hamsa's. The wishbone was there, a small, bleached relic of another life. He gave a cry that was amazement and... what? Something deep and painful wrenched out of him like nails splintering wood as they pulled free. Karu jumped, startled. What? Why do you have this? He had gone pale. It's brimstones. He sent it to me as the portals burned. Brimstone, he repeated. His face was alive with furious thought, and then understanding. Brimstone, he said again. What, Akiva? What he did then made Karu falter into silence. He sank to his knees. The cord around her neck gave way and the wishbone came away in his hand, and for an instant she felt bereft without it. But then he leaned into her. He pressed his face against her legs, and she felt the heat of it through her jeans. She stood astonished, looking down at his powerful shoulders as he curled into her, letting go of his glamour so his wings sprang visible. From around them on the bridge came gasps and cries. People stopped in their tracks, gaping. Zuzana and Mick broke from their embrace and spun to stare. Karu was only distantly aware of them. Gazing down at Akiva, she saw that his shoulders were shaking. Was he crying? Her hands fluttered, wanting to touch him, afraid of hurting him. Hating her Hamsas, she bent over him and stroked his hair with the backs of her fingers, his hot, hot brow with the backs of her hands. What is it? She asked. What's wrong? He straightened, still on his knees, and looked up at her. She was curved over him like a question mark. He held her legs, and she could feel tremors shaking his hands, the wishbone in his grip where he clasped the back of her knee. His wings unfolded. They came around like a pair of great fans, so the two of them were in a room of fire, more than ever in a world all their own. He searched her face, looking stunned and, Karu thought, terribly sad. And he told her, Karu, I know who you are. Chapter 35 The Tongue of Angels. I know who you are. Akiva, gazing up into Karu's face, saw what his words did to her. The hope at odds with the fear of hoping, her black eyes tear-glossed and shining with fire. Only then, seeing the reflection in her eyes, did he realize he'd dropped his glamour. There was a time when such carelessness could have gotten him killed. Now, he just didn't care. What? Karu's lips moved, but no sound came out. She cleared her throat. What did you say? How could he just tell her? He was reeling. Here was the impossible. And it was beautiful. And it was terrible.
and it flayed open his chest to show that his heart, numb for so long, was still vital and beating, just so it could be ripped out again after all these years? Was there any fate more bitter than to get what you long for most when it's too late?
Akiva, implored Karu.
Wide-eyed, distraught, she sank to her knees in front of him.
Tell me.
Karu, he whispered, and her name taunted him. Hope, so full of promise and recrimination that he almost wished he was dead. He couldn't look at her. He gathered her to him, and she let herself be gathered, supple as love. Her wind-mussed hair was like tousled silk, and he buried her face in it and tried to think what to tell her. All around a weave of murmurs and the weight of being watched, and Akiva registered almost none of it, until one sound fought its way forward. A throat was cleared, caustic and theatrically loud, a prickling of unease, and before any words were spoken, he'd already begun to turn.
Akiva, really, pull yourself together.
So out of place here, that voice, that language, his language. There, with swords sheathed at their sides and wearing twin expressions of dismay, stood Hazael and Laraz. Akiva couldn't even register surprise. The appearance of the seraphim was small next to the shocks that had been coming one after another all morning. The crescent moon knives, Karu's strange reaction to his tattoos, the dreamlike music of her laughter, and now the undeniable, the wishbone.
What are you doing here?
He asked them. His arms were still around Karu, who had lifted her head from his shoulder to stare at the intruders.
What are we doing here? Repeated Laraz. I think, all things considered, that question belongs to us. What in the name of the Godstars are you doing here?
She looked dumbfounded, and Akiva saw himself as she was seeing him, on his knees, weeping, entwined with a human girl. And it struck him how important it was that they think Karu was just that, a human girl. However strange it might seem, it was only that. Strange. The truth would be much worse. He straightened, still on his knees, and turned, ushering Karu behind him. Quietly, so his brother and sister wouldn't hear him speak the language of the enemy, he murmured, "Don't let them see your hands. They won't understand."
Understand what?
She murmured back, not taking her eyes from them, as they didn't take theirs from her.
Us, he said. They won't understand us.
I don't understand us either. But thanks to the wishbone, fragile in his fist, Akiva finally did. Karu lapsed into tense silence, keeping her eyes on the two seraphim. They had their wing glamours in place, but even so, their presence on the bridge seemed unnatural, and not a little unnerving. Laraz especially. Though Hazael was more powerful, Laraz was more frightening. She always had been. Perhaps she'd had to be, being female. Her pale hair was scraped back in severe plaits, and there was something coolly shark-like about her beauty. A flat, killer apathy. Hazael had more life in his eyes, but just now it was mostly a frank bafflement as he regarded Akiva before him, still on his knees.
Get up, he said, not unkindly. I can't stand the sight of you like that.
Akiva rose, drawing Karu up with him and keeping her behind the shield of his wings.
What's going on? Laraz demanded. Akiva, why did you come back here? And who is that?
She made a wild gesture of disgust toward Karu. Just a girl. Akiva heard himself echo Ezeel, sounding just as unconvincing as the old man had.
Just a girl who flies,
amended Laraz. A heartbeat's pause, and then Akiva said,
You've been following me.
What did you think?
Laraz spat.
That we'd let you vanish again. The way you were acting after Laura Mendy, we knew something was coming. But this...
What exactly is this?
Hazael asked, clearly still hoping for some explanation that would make it all okay. Akiva felt split down the middle. Here before him were his closest allies, and they felt like enemies. And it was his fault. If Akiva had a family, it was not his mother, who had turned away when the soldiers came to take him. And it was certainly not the Emperor. His family was these two. And there was no answer he could give them to make this make sense. There was nothing he could say to Karu either, who stood behind him desperate to know what had been kept from her all her life. A secret so big and so strange, he couldn't begin to find words to frame it. So he stood there mute, the languages of two races useless to help him explain anything.
I don't blame you wanting to get away, said Hazael,
always the peacemaker. He and Laraz bore a sibling resemblance they didn't share with Akiva. They were fair-haired and blue-eyed, with a blush to their honey skin. Hazael had an ease to him, almost a slouch, and for a resting expression, a lazy smile that could almost fool you into misjudging him. He was, always, a soldier. Reflexes and steel. But at heart he had managed somehow to retain something childlike that training and years of war worked hard to stamp out. He was a dreamer. He said,
I had thoughts myself of coming back to this world after everything.
But you didn't, snapped Laraz, who had within her no dreamer at all.
You didn't vanish in the night, leaving others to make up stories to cover for you, not knowing when or even if you'd come back this time.
I didn't ask you to cover for me, said Akiva.
No, but then you'd have to tell us where you were going. Instead, you snuck off just like before. And were we to wait for you to come back broken again and never tell us what had broken you?
Not this time, he said.
Laraz gave him a brittle smile, and Akiva knew that under her iciness she was hurt. He might never have returned. They might never have known what had happened to him. What did that say for decades they had protected one another? Hadn't it been Laraz years ago who had risked her life to return to the battlefield at Bullfinch, against any expectation that he might still be alive, and with Chimera crawling over their victory and spitting the wounded on spikes. She had returned and found him and borne him away. She had risked her life for him, and would again without hesitation. And so would Hazael, and Akiva would for them. But he couldn't tell them why he'd come here, or what he'd found.
Not this time what? Liraz demanded. You're not coming back broken? Or you're not coming back at all?
I didn't plan anything. I just couldn't stay there.
He groped to explain. He owed them the effort, at least.
After Laura Mendy, an end was reached, and it was like the edge of a cliff. There was nothing else I wanted, nothing except...
He left the rest unsaid. He didn't need to say it. They'd seen him on his knees. They'd fix their eyes on Karu.
Except her, said Laraz. A human,
if that's what she is.
What else would she be?
He said, covering a spark of fear.
I have a theory,
she said, and Akiva's heart lurched.
Last night, when she attacked you, there was something strange about that fight, wasn't there, Hazael?
Strange, agreed Hazael.
We weren't close enough to feel any magic, but it certainly seemed as though you were feeling it.
Akiva's thoughts spun furiously. How could he get Karu away from here?
You seem to have forgiven her for it, though.
Laraz came a step closer.
Is there anything you want to tell us?
Akiva retreated, keeping Karu behind him. Leave her alone, he said. Laraz advanced.
If you have nothing to hide,
let us see her. In a sorrowful voice that was worse than Laraz's sharp tone, Hazael said, Akiva, just tell us it isn't what it looks like. Just tell us she isn't. Akiva felt a kind of rushing around him, years of secrets catching him up like a wind he wished with a wild kind of surrender that could just bear him away, with Karu, to a place without Seraphim and Chimera and their talent for hate, without humans to stand around and gape, without anyone to come between them ever again.
Of course she isn't, he said.
It came out as a snarl, and Laraz took it as a challenge to prove it. What Karu was, and what she wasn't. And her eyes flashed with a look Akiva knew too well, a hard fury she harnessed on the battlefield. She came closer. Adrenaline surged hot as his hands seized into fists, the wishbone bowing under the pressure, and he braced himself for what must come next. Sick incredulity washed over him that it had come to this. But whatever he expected to happen, it was not for Karu to speak up in a clear, cool voice and ask,
What?
What am I not? Laraz halted, her fury blinking to shock. Hazael looked startled too, and it took Akiva a beat to realize why. But with a start, he did. Karu's words. They were as smooth as falling water. They were in his language. She had spoken the tongue of angels, which she had no way, earthly or otherwise, of knowing. In the hesitation wrought by her question, she stepped out from the shelter of his wings and stood exposed before Laraz and Hazael. Then, with the same bright savagery she had smiled at Akiva when she attacked him the night before, she said to Laraz, If you want to see my hands, all you have to do is ask. Chapter 36. To do else than kill. All it took was a luck now from her pocket, and a whispered wish, and the words of the seraphim swam from melodious flow into meaning. Another language for Karu's collection, and it was a prize. She already knew from the hard, darting eyes of the female seraph and the protective stance of Akiva that they were talking about her.
Just tell us she isn't, said the male,
letting his words trail into some unspoken horror, as if he were pleading with Akiva to disprove their suspicions about her. Who did they think she was? Was she to stand here mute while they talked her over? What? She asked. What am I not? She saw their faces freeze in shock as she stepped out from behind Akiva. The female angel was just paces away, staring. She had the dead eyes of a jihadist, and Karu felt a tremor of vulnerability with Akiva no longer between them. She thought of her crescent moon knives sitting useless in her flat, and then she realized she didn't need them. She had a weapon tailored just to Seraphim. She was a weapon tailored just to Seraphim. The smile rose unbidden from her phantom self, and she said with a leaping, dark excitement, If you want to see my hands, all you have to do is ask. And then, there on the Charles Bridge in full view of gawkers, their upheld phones and cameras capturing it for the world, and with the police approaching, wary and grim-faced, all hell broke loose.
No,
cried Akiva, but it was too late. Miraz moved first, like a slash of a knife, and she was fast. Bakaru matched her with a knife-like speed of her own. She threw up her hands, and the air rippled with the expulsion of magic. It made a slow-motion tracery, hanging there for a second like a warp. And then it hit. Its fringes shivered wide to catch Hazael and Akiva, and they both staggered. Liraz, though, was hurled back like a flicked bug. She twisted, acrobatic, and landed on her feet with a concussive force that shook the bridge. In the aftermath of the blast, only Karu stood straight. Her hair had been caught, as in a backdraft, sucked forward and then turned loose, and it floated on the churning air. She was still smiling, cold. With her drifting hair and her palms outfaced with their staring ink eyes, she looked malevolent, even to Zuzana, like some species of fell goddess in the unconvincing guise of a girl. Zuzana, Mick, and the other onlookers faltered back. Liraz dropped her glamour, and it was as though the veil that had cloaked them was drawn away to reveal a raging fire. Hazael dropped his glamour, too, and moved to his sister's side. And a battle line was drawn, the two angels facing Karu, their heads lowered against the misery her Hamsas were pulsing at them. Akiva stood between them, stricken. He had to move to one side or the other, a step or two in either direction, just that. And it was a choice that would define him forever. He looked rapidly back and forth between his comrades and Karu.
Akiva,
hissed Liraz. She expected him to come to them. It had always been the three of them, advancing against the enemy, killing, and afterward drawing the rough tally marks on one another's hands with knife tips and campfire soot. To them, Karu was just another tattoo waiting to happen, a line to be carved. And then there was Karu, so ready to raise her hands and unleash Brimstone's noxious magic. It doesn't have to be like this, Akiva said. But his voice was thin, as if he didn't believe it himself.
It is like this, said Liraz. Don't be a child, Akiva.
He was still between them, straddling two possible futures. Liraz said,
If you can't kill her yourself, then go. You don't have to see it. We'll never speak of it again. It's over. Do you hear me? Go home.
She spoke with urgency and resolution. She really believed she was taking care of him, and that this thing with Karu, so beyond her ken, was some madness to be forcibly forgotten. He said,
I'm not going home.
Hazael.
What do you mean you're not going home? After all you've done, all you've fought for, it's a new age, brother. Peace.
It's not peace. Peace is more than the absence of war. Peace is accord, harmony.
Harmony with beasts, you mean.
Mistrust shaded into Hazael's expression. And disgust. And still the hope that it was all a misunderstanding. When Akiva answered, he knew he was crossing a final border, beyond all possibility of misinterpretation or return. It was a border he should have crossed a long time ago. Everything had gotten so twisted. He had gotten so twisted.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Karu broke her gaze away from the two intruders to glance at him. The hard smile had left her face already, and now, as she sensed his turmoil, even her upheld hands faltered. Thoughts of herself, her answers, her emptiness were forgotten, all overshadowed by Akiva's anguish, which she felt like it was her own. The police arrived. They hesitated in the face of this otherworldly tableau. Karu saw their baffled faces, their nervous guns, and she saw the way they looked at her, There were angels on the Charles Bridge, and she was their foe. She, enemy of angels, in her black coat and evil tattoos, with her lashing blue hair and black eyes. They, so golden, the very image of church frescoes come to life. She was the demon in this scene, and she half expected, glancing at her shadow sharp before her, to see that it had horns. It did not. Her shadow was a girl's shadow, and seemed in that moment to have nothing at all to do with her. Akiva, who a moment ago had pressed his face against her legs and wept, stood stock still, and Karu felt fear for the first time since the two angels had come upon them. If he should take their side. "Akiva," she whispered. "I'm here," he said. And when he moved, it was to her. There had never been any doubt, only a hope that somehow the choice wouldn't be forced, that the moment could be backed away from. But it was too late for that. So he stepped into his future, coming between Karu and his brother and sister. And he said to them in a low but steady voice, "I won't let you harm her. There are other ways to live. We have it in us to do else than kill." Hazael and Liraz stared at him. Unthinkably, he had chosen the girl. Liraz's shock quickly turned to bitterness. "Do we?" she flung back at him. "That's a convenient position to take now, isn't it?" Karu had lowered her hands when Akiva came before her. She reached out, just her fingertips to his back, because she couldn't help it. He told her, "Karu, you have to go."
"Go, but..."
"Get away from here. I'll keep them from following you." His voice was grim with what that would mean, but his decision was made. He gave her a quick look over his shoulder. His face was strained but set. "I'll meet you in the place we first saw each other. Promise me you'll wait for me there." The place they first saw each other. The Jemaa Alfana, heart of Marrakesh, where she had caught his burning gaze through the chaos of a crowd and been pierced through the soul by it. Akiva said in a voice hoarse with urgency, "Promise me, Karu, promise you won't go with Razgat until I find you, until I explain." Karu wanted to promise. She saw that he had thrown his allegiance to her, even against his own kind. He had surely saved her life. Could she have survived an attack by two armed seraphim? In addition to which, he had chosen her. Wasn't that what she had always wanted? To be chosen? Cherished? He had given up his place in his own world for her, and he was asking that she wait for him in Marrakesh. But something unyielding in her shrank from the promise. He might have chosen her, but that didn't mean that she would do the same if she were faced with the same choice. Against Brimstone, Issa, Yasri, Twiga. She had told Brimstone, "I want you to know I would never just leave you." And she wouldn't. She would choose her family. Anything else was unthinkable, though even now the idea of turning and leaving Akiva behind brought on physical pain. She said, "I'll wait for you as long as I can. That's the best I can do." And she thought the brilliance of his burning wings dimmed just a little. He said in a hollow voice, still faced away from her, "Then that will have to be good enough." Liraz drew her sword, and Hazael followed suit. The police responded by falling back, raising their guns, shouting in Czech for the angels to drop their weapons. The onlookers cried out in a kind of ecstatic terror. Zuzana, jostled among them, kept her eyes on Karu. Akiva, whose swords were less obvious in their crossed sheaths between his wings, reached double-handed over his shoulders and drew them with a harmonic ringing.
Without looking back, he urged, "Karu, go!"
She gathered herself into a crouch, and just before she sprang skyward to vanish into the ether in a streak of blue and black, she said, both choked and pleading, "Come and find me, Akiva." And then she was gone, and he was left alone to face the fallout of his shattering choice. Once upon a time, an angel lay dying in the mist, and a devil knelt over him and smiled. Chapter 37 Dream Lost. Akiva was helpless to keep his blood in his body. It pulsed up under his fingers and escaped, riding the tide of his heartbeat out in hot spurts. He couldn't stop the bleeding. The wound was a mauling, and clutching at it was a little like gathering a fistful of meat scraps to fling to a dog. He was going to die. Around him, the world had lost its horizons. Sea mist choked Bullfinch Beach, and Akiva heard waves breaking, but could see only as far as the nearest corpses, gray hummocks obscured by the fog. They might have been Chimera or Seraphim. Except for the nearest one, he couldn't tell. That one lay only a few yards away, with his own sword embedded in it. The beast had been part hyena, part lizard, a monstrosity, and it had raked him open from collarbone to biceps, rending his mail as easily as cloth. It had clung to him, its teeth meeting through the flesh of his shoulder, even after he'd skewered it through its barreled chest. He'd twisted his blade, thrust deeper, twisted again. The beast had screamed deep in its throat, but didn't let him go until it died. Now, as Akiva lay waiting to die, the post-battle silence was split by a roar. He stiffened and clasped his wound tighter. Later, he would wonder why he'd done that. He should have let go, tried to die before they could reach him. The enemy was stalking the field, killing the wounded. They had taken the day, driven the Seraphim back to the fortifications at Morwin Bay, and they had no interest in prisoners. Akiva should have hurried his dying, slipped away in the calm of blood loss, like falling asleep. The enemy would be far less kind. What made him wait? The hope of killing one more Chimera? But if that was it, why didn't he try to drag himself over to retrieve his sword? He just lay there, holding his wound, living those extra few minutes for no reason that he could fathom. And then he saw her. She was just a silhouette at first. Vast bat wings, long, ridged gazelle horns as sharp as spikes, the bestial parts of the enemy. Black loathing filled Akiva, and he watched her pause beside first one corpse and then the next. She came to the body of the hyena lizard and stood there a long moment. What was she doing? Death rites? She turned and prowled toward Akiva. She came clearer with every step. She was slender, her legs long, lean human thighs that gave way below the knee, to the sleek taper of gazelle's legs, the fine cloven hooves making her seem to balance on pins. Her wings were folded, her gait both graceful and tense with suppressed power. In one hand she held a crescent moon blade. Another, just like it, was sheathed at her thigh. With the other hand she raised a long staff that was not a weapon. It was curved like a shepherd's crook, with something silver. A lantern? Suspended from the end. No, not a lantern. It gave off not light, but smoke. A few steps, hooves sinking into the sand, then the mist revealed her face to him, and his to her. She stopped abruptly when she saw he was alive. He braced for a snarl, a sudden lunge, and new pain as he was gutted by her blade. But the Chimera girl didn't move. For a long moment, they just looked at each other. She cocked her head to one side, a quizzical, bird-like gesture that spoke not of savagery, but curiosity. There was no snarl on her lips. Her face was solemn. Unaccountably, she was beautiful. She took a step closer. He watched her face as she drew nearer. His gaze slipped down her long neck to the ridges of her collarbones. She was finely made, elegant and spare. Her hair was short as swan's down, soft and dark and close as a cap, so the architecture of her face was unobscured. Perfect. Black grease paint made a mask around her eyes, which Akiva could see were large, brown and bright, vivid and sorrowful. He knew the sorrow was for her fallen comrades and not for him, but he still found himself transfixed by the compassion in her gaze. It made him think that perhaps he had never really looked at a chimera before. He saw slaves often enough, but they kept their eyes on the ground, and warriors like this he only ever met while dodging a killing blow or dealing one, half blind with the blood rage of battle. If he ignored the fact of her bloodied blade and her closely fitted black armor, her devilish wings and horns, if he focused just on her face, so unexpectedly lovely, she looked like a girl who had found a young man dying on the beach. For a moment, that's what he was, not a soldier, not anyone's enemy, and the death that was upon him seemed meaningless. That they lived as they did, angels and monsters locked in a volley of killing and dying, dying and killing, seemed an arbitrary choice. As if they might just as well choose not to kill and die. But no. That was all there was between them. And this girl was here for the same reason he was, to slay the enemy. And that meant him. Why, then, didn't she do it? She knelt at his side, doing nothing to protect herself from any sudden move he might make. He remembered the knife at his hip. It was small, nothing like her own fantastical double crescent. But it could kill her. In one motion, he could embed it in the soft curve of her throat. Her perfect throat. He made no move. He was dream-lost by then. Blood-lost, gazing up at the face above him. He was beyond wondering whether this was real. It could be a dying dream, or she could be a reaper sent from the next life to cull his soul. The silver censer hung on its crook, exhaling a fume of smoke that was both herbal and sulfurous, and as its scent wafted down to him, Akiva felt a tug, a lure. Dizzy, he thought he wouldn't mind following this messenger into the next realm. He imagined her guiding him by the hand, and with that serene image cradled in his mind, he let go of his wound to reach for her fingers, caught them in his, which were slippery with blood. Her eyes went wide, and she snatched her hand away. He'd startled her. He hadn't meant to. "I'll go with you," he said, speaking in Chimera, which he knew enough of to give orders to slaves. It was a rough tongue, a cobbling together of many tribal dialects that the Empire had brought under one roof, and which had been melded over time into a common language. He could scarcely hear his own voice, but she made out his words well enough. She glanced at her censer, then back at him. "That's not for you," she said, taking it away and planting it in the mud where the breeze would tease the smoke downwind. "I don't think you want to go where I'm going." Even under the animal inflections of the language, her voice was as pretty as a song. "Death," said Akiva. His life was leaving him fast now that he no longer held his wound. His eyes just wanted to drift closed.